It is Wednesday, August 24th, 2022. Welcome into episode 49 of Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone. It is a production of John Boy Media, and it is weekly pitching talk with the five-time World Series champ and the Cy Young Award winner, David Cone, the research ace, James Smythe, and myself, Justin Shackle. Subway Series has been wrapped up, at least for the regular season. There's a lot of talk after the final game on Tuesday night to both managers. Hey, can you see yourself in this moment in October? And it's just a cool thing to talk about. But David, James, you guys were both in the building the last two games. I was there as well at Yankee Stadium. There was a big buzz. A lot of fans from both teams, and Yankee Stadium was packed. This is a good thing. Like, you know, on the surface, yeah, no brainer, Shackle. Obviously, it's a good thing. But I think in years past, people are kind of questioning what the energy was like, if this kind of got stale a little bit. I think it's as strong as ever when two teams are doing really well and you put them in one ballpark in the same city.
It's a valid point. I mean, I played in the first one at Yankee Stadium in 1997, and it was packed. It was half Mets fans in Yankee Stadium. We'd never seen that before. It was electric. I remember pitching the final game. I had a no-hitter actually going, and John Olerud broke it up in the seventh inning, and all the Mets fans raised up out of their seats and started doing the "Let's go Mets" chant. And I was blown away by it. Exactly how it felt last night. All these years later, it felt like the first time. It really did. It hasn't changed a bit because the Mets are good this year, and they anticipate a big year, and they're having a big year, and the Yankees are trying to bust out. They've had a historic first half, but now a little slump, but now coming out of it, a big, really exciting games. Fans really into it. It really did feel like the first time. And that first time in 1997, was pretty spectacular.
The crowds were phenomenal, both at Citi Field last month and Yankee Stadium here. And what struck me is being in a lot of these Subway Series games, the split in fans at each park, it was way closer to 50-50 than any other time that I could recall, where you have a lot of Met fans at Yankee Stadium, you have a lot of Yankee fans at Citi Field, and that buzz was palpable from the first pitch to the last out in all four games. And there were four extremely well-played games, great pitching, clutch hitting, down the line, all four games decided by three runs or fewer. I don't know if New York could handle a Subway Series like that come October.
It's so true. I mean, it felt like the place to be, you know, the climax of the summer. We're in the third week in August. The stars were out. Everybody wanted to be there last night for that game. It was the place to be, Yankee Stadium last night.
Yeah, it was electric. So cool. We're going to have Keith Hernandez on to talk about the Subway Series, the Mets, Max Scherzer, and everything that is happening with the NL East race and how the Mets are doing as we focus in now on these last 6 weeks of the season. So we'll talk to Keith. We'll touch on Jordan Montgomery, what he's been able to do since turning into a St. Louis Cardinal. We'll touch on Walker Buehler. Fernando Tatis spoke to his teammates for the first time. So a lot to tackle here this week. But just for the opener, David, we go back to the Subway Series, and we saw a lot from the Yankees. And I think that was a good thing because they had a lot to prove in these two games with the Mets, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. It's not only just the fall off in performance, the recent slumps, the injuries, but the trade acquisitions too, under a lot of stress. So to see those guys come through, Frankie Montas having a big start in pinstripes, you know, in a big game was nice to see. Andrew Benintendi getting it going, starting to swing the bat, actually in the leadoff hole, becoming a force for the Yankees and a valuable weapon moving around. Trevino, the reliever, came up big recently with that 7-out save, the old school save that he got in a big spot. So you could kind of see it all coming together. Still waiting on Harrison Bader. Obviously, Jordan Montgomery is going to be a big topic as he's just killing it in St. Louis, but stay tuned. You know, this is kind of coming back around a little bit for the Yankees. They've stopped the bleeding, kind of righted the ship a little bit. Now you can kind of see where all these pieces fit in, and there's a plan in place, and we'll see how it plays out down the stretch.
What about Frankie Montas? Because he was making his fourth start on Tuesday night, probably the biggest game. He had pitched at Fenway against the Red Sox, but the Red Sox aren't the Mets this year at the moment. So he gave up two runs over 5 2/3. And from a stuff perspective, he looked pretty good. It looked like a promising start, a step in the right direction. What do you think we learned from Frankie Montas' start against the Mets?
It's always difficult with a new pitcher when he comes over to call a game. Well, you know, what pitches do you throw? What situations do you like to throw your pitches in? And we saw in his allocation of pitches in his first three starts as a Yankee that it was off compared to what it normally was in Oakland all those years. It was a lot less sliders, a lot less cutters. We kind of got pigeonholed into a fastball split combo because I don't think they were quite ready for him. I'm not putting blame on Trevino in the game he called, but Kyle Higashioka got behind the plate, and it looked like they had a much better distribution of his pitches. He threw more sliders and cutters. He threw them for strikes, and he kind of saved his splitter for swing and miss counts where he could use it more effectively. And that's what I liked. You know, when I first saw him the first two or three games, I'm like, slider's not very good. He's not using it enough. He's not throwing it for strikes. He's putting a lot of pressure on his splitter to throw one for a strike and one to miss within a strikeout pitch. And when you start throwing splitters for strikes, it flattens out and they can get hit. It's not high quality. It's not the way the pitch was designed to be thrown. So a much better of pitches through his slider and his cutter for strikes a lot in the middle counts to get back into counts. His fastball was explosive up to 98. He's got a four seamer and a two seamer. The two seamer into righties was very effective, especially on Pete Alonso, and then double up with that with four seamers up in the zone. So now you can kind of see the formula and the right distribution of pitches for Frankie Montas. It was much, much better with Kyle Higashioka behind the plate, a much better feel for what he wants to do and what pitches to call and what pitches to throw.
The last note on your scouting report on the broadcast last night was find the formula. You think he found the formula for that?
Much better. Absolutely. Much more on track. I just saw a better high quality on the break and the spin on his slider. He could backdoor it to lefties to get strikes, take some pressure off of his fastball. I was kind of worried about the platoon splits. If he gets down to just a two-pitch pitcher and a fastball split, what about right-handed batters? What about the days when you struggle with your splitter? I threw a splitter a lot. On the days I struggled with my splitter, I went to more curveballs and breaking balls. I tried to find another way. And that's what we saw last night with Montas, is that he found another way, took some pressure off of that good split finger fastball, and threw it to both sides of the plate. That's the thing. If you can throw your breaking ball to both sides of the plate, if you can backdoor it to lefties and get strikes, you can obviously throw it away to righties to get swings and misses. To me, that's the key. If you can throw your breaking ball, either your slider or your cutter, to both sides of the plate, that's a big deal for a guy like Montas and take some pressure off of his other pitches.
A good sign for Frankie Montas as it relates to the coming weeks and as the Yankees gear up for October. And fair or not, look, Frankie Montas took Jordan Montgomery's rotation spot. And it's not like they were part of the same trade, but they were traded within a matter of a couple of days. So you have Montas starting to kind of prove his worth, show a good sign in that start against the Mets. That's all Jordan Montgomery has done since he was traded to St. Louis with the Cardinals. The guy threw a Maddux on Monday at Wrigley Field. It was kind of cool. After the Yankees win over the Mets, I was in the clubhouse covering Yankees postgame, but you could visibly see Jameson Taillon watching Montgomery start on his phone. Then they had the game on the TV in the clubhouse, and you had some of his former Yankee teammates cheering him on there. But he throws a Maddux, complete game, shutout, under 100 pitches. Jordan Montgomery's 4-0 in four starts as a St. Louis Cardinal. Can he continue to pitch at a high rate for St. Louis?
I don't see why not. I am so happy for Jordan Montgomery. He's such a good kid. He's worked so hard. It's a perfect fit for him in St. Louis. They have great defense behind him. They have gold glovers all over the field, including Arenado at third base. And Jordan Montgomery, as a lefty, needs that left side of the infield, especially against right-handed batters when he's throwing curveballs and cutters and changeups. That's a big deal, kind of like Andy Pettitte and Scott Brosius. It's a big deal to have a good left side of the infield for a pitcher like Montgomery. I think he fits in perfectly with the Cardinals. He's probably got a better chance to stay there long-term. I would not be surprised to see the Cardinals try to sign him long-term. He's got one more year under arbitration, under contractual control, before they have to re-sign him. So, yeah, I think that's just the perfect fit, even though it stings right now for Yankee fans to see his success and say, wow, he could be in the Yankee rotation. But Frankie Montas wasn't Jordan Montgomery's. This wasn't the design. Wasn't supposed to be the replacement. It was supposed to be Domingo Germán was really replacing Jordan Montgomery's spot in the rotation. Everybody thought universally that Montas was a legitimate number two guy. He was an ace. Nobody thought was making that comparison to Montgomery. Montgomery was your fourth or fifth starter. He's pitching like a number two guy now and with the Cardinals, and you can't help but compare him to Montas, but that was never really the original plan. It was more, can we get by with Domingo Germán or Clark Schmidt replacing Jordan Montgomery's spot in the Yankee rotation? Montas was a foregone conclusion. He's going to be a number two. He's an ace. He's going to start the second game of the playoffs. And now all of a sudden, whoa, what's going on here? So that's why last night was a big deal for him to pitch well in pinstripes against the Mets at Yankee Stadium. We'll see how it shakes down the rest of the way, but big pitcher next year at this time. Let's see what kind of year Harrison Bader has as a Yankee center fielder. Let's see where Jordan Montgomery is. I'm happy for Jordan. I think he's in the perfect spot. I think long-term he could be a Cardinal for a long time and get paid, get a long-term deal there potentially and be a perfect fit there.
And the trade looks as bad as it could, you know, a few weeks out, because Montas had one of the worst three-start stretches of his entire career, all while Jordan Montgomery was having the best four-start span of his entire big league career. Obviously, he's not going to pitch to a 0.35 ERA, but even in New York, he showed he was a solid, above average, you know, 100s to 110s ERA plus, a very valuable, solid contributor, even with limited upside.
Yeah. Advice to everyone out there listening who wants to kind of judge this trade between the Yankees and Cardinals four starts into Jordan Montgomery's tenure in St. Louis. You can't. You have to wait, you know, a year, multiple years perhaps, to see how this pans out with Montgomery in St. Louis and now Harrison Bader in New York. But a couple of notes. I mean, Jordan Montgomery, James mentioned the ERA, one run allowed in 25 and two-thirds innings of work. St. Louis has only scored 10 runs in his four starts. And that was obviously a sticking point in his time with the Yankees, getting no run support. Well, he's finding a way to get it done without the run support in St. Louis. And the Cardinals creating a lot of separation now between them and the Brewers in the NL Central. They are 8-0 in eight games started by Jordan Montgomery and Jose Quintana, their other starting pitching pickup at the trade deadline. All right, guys, Walker Buehler underwent a second Tommy John surgery earlier this week. Obviously, and unfortunately, a worst case scenario, because they didn't realize that he'd need the Tommy John until they went in for a flexor tendon repair. And once they were within that procedure, so Buehler gone for some time. Then you think about this Dodger rotation. I know we touched on it last week, but looking ahead to the offseason, Clayton Kershaw, Tyler Anderson, Andrew Heaney, they are all set to hit free agency. So with Walker Buehler going down now, do the antennas of a, I don't know, Jacob DeGrom or a Justin Verlander, two guys with opt-outs this offseason, do they go up when they hear this news?
No, their agents do. Their agents are keeping track of this stuff. So it is I'll follow, as they say. The Dodgers also have a very deep farm system. They have some other young pitchers on the way up that I'm sure you haven't even heard their names yet in AA and AAA that are getting closer. So that's something to follow. But yes, to answer your question and with a short answer, absolutely yes. You think about that. The Dodgers have tremendous resources. It's a great place to pitch. It's one of the favorite all-time mounds of any pitcher who's ever pitched there. For generations, back to Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax, I've heard this. The first time I got on the Dodger Stadium mound and pitched, I was like, wow, this is a great place to pitch. You just feel like you're on top of the hitter. There's something about the mound, the atmosphere, the background, your depth perception there. It's a pretty fair ballpark. You got to hit it pretty solidly to get it out of there. Just a great place to pitch. Everybody loves pitching there. Everybody wants to pitch there.
Really quick, best mound you've ever pitched on in the big leagues, what was it?
Dodger Stadium is right up there. It really is. It was one of the great places to pitch. I like the tradition too. I loved pitching at old Yankee Stadium and at Fenway Park. Even at Wrigley could be, you know, the hair on your neck could stand up because of the wind blowing out at Wrigley Field. It could be very challenging. But once again, I pay attention to the background, the stadiums that the back wall behind the play home plate is closer to home plate. There's not a lot of foul territory behind home plate. That makes a pitcher's depth perception feel like you're on top of the hitter. Makes you feel like you're throwing harder. Makes like you could feel like you could reach out and hand the ball to the catcher's mitt. So those are the type of places I loved. Wrigley Field was like that. Fenway was like that. Yankee Stadium somewhat like that. Dodger Stadium's like that. So those are the kind of places I love to pitch. The old Candlestick Park, was one of my favorite places to pitch because of the wind. I felt like I was throwing a blitz ball. My ball was moving like crazy at Candlestick Park, and that depth perception was there as well. So yeah, little things make a difference for a pitcher, and certainly visually makes a difference.
All right, talking about the hair standing up on the back of your neck, David, that happened earlier this month with the Padres for all the wrong reasons, because we heard Fernando Tatis getting popped for 80 games for testing positive for a PED. Honestly, a little cringeworthy just because of what he's been able to accomplish. And then the storylines between him falling off a motorcycle, hurting his wrist, obviously not even being a factor into the Padres season so far in 2022. He's obviously not going to be moving forward. And he addressed the Padres clubhouse in a players-only meeting on Tuesday. What did Fernando Tatis Jr. need to say to start repairing his status with his teammates? And then on the reverse, what did teammates need to say to Tatis to kind of get everyone on the same page?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, it's a crushing blow that I don't even think he fathoms yet. When you have the ownership there doing all they can do to make a run, and you're up against it with the Dodgers, you know, who are a juggernaut, and the excitement in San Diego, I was out there recently, the sellout crowds, the anticipation of getting him back after the Juan Soto trade, they were on the upswing. This is a crushing, crushing blow to that organization, that fan base, that ownership group, who has really put their best foot forward. I don't think he fully grasps that yet. He's too selfish. He's too immature. Just one time you'd want to see a player in that situation say, you know what? I made a huge mistake. I did it because I was injured and I wanted to come back and help my team. I wanted to take a shortcut. I made a really bad decision. I was tempted by it. I thought I could heal my wrist because I was desperate to get back and help my team. And I made a huge mistake. Why don't we hear that more? You know, you just admit it. Admit that you did it because, you know what? I got the lines are blurred. I really wanted to get back and I cheated. I cheated so I could heal my wrist. I thought it would help because I was desperate to get back. Instead, it's, I didn't know what I took, or fungus on my head, or some sort of cockamamie excuse that, you know, I didn't know what I was taking. It was some substance that was in something I drank. I hate that. I hate that with a passion. Just own it. Own it. Say, you know what? I got tempted. I made the wrong decision. I was desperate. I wanted to come back. My bad. I'm so sorry. This is going to haunt me the rest of my life. That's what you want to hear, you know, just own it. And I don't know if we heard that. He needs to hear from his team. He needs to hear from his players about the impact that his actions have on not just his team, the whole fan base, the whole sport, the ownership group, everything they're doing to try to get it going there in San Diego, all the prospects they traded for Juan Soto, everything. There's a domino effect down the list that he has impacted everything and everyone. And he needs to understand that. And I'm not sure he fully does yet.
Yeah, I think the fallout from the initial suspension, the announcement, and then his excuses like with ringworm and stuff like that, that part was cringe. I agree with you. I hate that too. I'm sure James is an
just own it.
That
just either. Own it. Just say, you know what? I got tempted. The devil made me do it. You know, it's I got rough. Tempted. I was desperate to get back. My wrist, you know, was killing me. And I thought maybe I could take a shortcut. Maybe I could get away with it. I got caught and I was stupid. And, you know, just one time you want to hear that.
Yeah. This one in particular kind of, it made me laugh a little bit harder because growing up, I wrestled all the way through high school. I was a wrestler. And one of the things that you kind of have to watch out for on wrestling mat, you're always warned about it too with your coaches is, take, you know, ringworm, you know, make sure you go home and you shower immediately after practice. But also at the same time, something like that is kind of inevitable along the way. So I've had ringworm in my life. I know how to treat it. I'm sure Lamisil is okay with some of the Major League Baseball guidelines. Yeah. But it's just laughable. But players came out, his teammates in the Padres clubhouse. I know Manny Machado, I have the quote right here. Say, hey, we've all made dumb mistakes that we regret. We got to move past it, learn from it, hold yourself accountable. And he said what he needed to say. We're all family here. Joe Musgrove kind of saying the same thing. This, you know, it's not an easy conversation to have, but for him to come in, face the team face to face, be honest with us, let us know what happened. That's what everyone wanted. So reportedly, there were hugs reportedly at the end, but we'll see.
The immaturity is stunning. Yeah. Just riding the motorcycles. You know, when he was asked in spring training, did you hurt your wrist for riding the motorcycle? His answer was, which time? Mm-hmm. And this stunning level of immaturity and lack of awareness that everything he does impacts not only himself, but everybody else, that whole team, that whole city, that whole ownership group. That's a lesson that needs to be learned, that when you're young, immature, and selfish, you don't understand that. You're not aware. There's a tremendous lack of awareness there of how your actions impact a lot of other people.
The most underrated words in life, professionally, personally, I was wrong. I made a mistake. You know, I did something stupid. I'm sorry.
And exactly. then when you 100% there. And then you think about how he, you know, just signed a contract that's going to tie him with the Padres organization for over the next decade. I think a lot of young people fail to realize, look, when you get that bag, that's when the hard work begins. You know, you did a lot to get there to accomplish that for sure. But with that contract carries an enormous amount of responsibility. And in a sense, that's when the hard work really starts.
You're trying to become a part of forever. When you win a World Series championship as a team, you are a part of forever. And that means everything. Trust me, the further removed I get from the championships I was a part of with the Yankees and even with the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays are having an anniversary this weekend for the 92 World Series championship team. You're part of forever. That means something, you know. So therefore, you got to sacrifice some things. You got to say, not ride your motorcycle in the offseason. You got to be careful. You got to make some sacrifices. You got to be a little selfless because it's worth it.
So you have, do you have a conflict this weekend here? You have Mets Old Timers Day. And then are they on separate days?
They're on the same day. I had committed to the Mets before the Blue Jays had called me and asked me. So I had to honor my first commitment to the Mets, but yeah, it's the same day. The 92 Blue Jays are being honored in Toronto on Saturday as well. So, but yeah, I did a video for them, you know, that they're going to include in the ceremony. So, but yes, that's 1992. They're still calling us. They still want to remember us. They still want to honor you. People still remember that fondly. It just means so much more than you realize it does when you're a player, when you're young, like Tatis Jr. is. Maybe you're not, you just don't have that awareness of what it means to so many different people that you just, it's bigger than who you are. And you need to understand that.
People, this is your chance to turn big league action into big winnings with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. Right now, new customers can bet just $5 on any game and get $100 in free bets instantly. Plus, all customers can combine multiple bets for a shot at an even bigger payout with DraftKings same game parlays. At DraftKings Sportsbook, you'll be able to bet on your favorite batter to hit a double in his next plate appearance, your favorite pitcher's next pitch to be a strike, and so much more. We have entered the dog days, but they are exciting. There are some interesting division races still to be sorted out. The wild card races are tight as well. DraftKings is safe, secure, and reliable. Best of all, you can deposit and withdraw your cash whenever you want. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code SLAB. That's S-L-A-B. New customers can make any $5 bet and get $100 in free bets instantly. That's promo code SLAB only at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. Minimum age and eligibility restrictions apply. See show notes for details. MLB trademarks used with permission.
All right, let's get to our conversation with Keith Hernandez on the heels of the Subway Series wrapping up, at least in the regular season. And James, a lot of our listeners and viewers, they probably just know Keith Hernandez as the Mets broadcaster on Sportsnet New York. We dove into it a little bit, but let's try and put it into perspective on how much of a player Keith Hernandez was over at first base. Can you do that for us?
Right. He was one of the great first basemen of all time. 17 MLB seasons. He was the 1979 NL MVP. Coney gets into it a little bit with Keith talking about that, but he led the National League with a .344 average, 48 doubles and 116 runs that year. It was actually a tie with Willie Stargell for the MVP, if you can imagine something like that happening today. Two World Series titles with the 1982 Cardinals and the 1986 Mets. Five-time All-Star, 11 Gold Gloves, the most ever at first base. Not bad for a 42nd round pick. And you look at his Hall of Fame case, and people are saying, you know, banging the drum a little more for a for Keith. You look at the old school stats, and he's a little lacking in power, but he was playing in a pitcher-friendly time. 60 career WAR is usually a good conversation starter or benchmark for the Hall of Fame, and he's right there at 60, tied with Harmon Killebrew, two completely different type of players who provided similar value, and Keith, absolutely one of the best defensive first basemen of all time.
He's a member of the Mets and the Cardinals Hall of Fame, two-time World Series champion, like you mentioned, and he's going to be participating in Mets Old Timers Day with David coming up this weekend over at Citi Field. Let's get to our conversation. Keith Hernandez with us this week on Tone the Slab, pitching with David Cohn. All right, Keith Hernandez is with us right out of the gate. Keith, we saw the Subway Series play out for this year, two games at Citi Field, two games at Yankee Stadium. And with the success of both teams so far in 2022, what'd you think of the Subway Series this year?
I was surprised it was only four games. I thought, I was talking to David last night, and it's like, why did they not schedule a three-game series? I mean, it's a big draw. I mean, you filled up Yankee Stadium and certainly filled up Citi Field. I couldn't understand that. I'm not a big fan of interleague play, but I do believe just have one series home and away against your rivals. And the New York, it's perfect. And play more in your league and out of division. I think it would be better, but it's not going to happen that way next year. But I think of the division, I'm not answering your question, of the Subway Series, that was great. I mean, the Yankees are banged up big time. I mean, they're really wounded, and they took two out of two from the Mets. I think the Mets were on the end of a real tough stretch of games. They had the five-game series at home against Atlanta. They took four out of five, and then they had a little respite, and then they went to Atlanta and lost three out of four, went to Philly and won three out of four, and then they kind of came into Yankee Stadium. I think they were just a little bit, I think they're a little bit worn. I think Pete looked tired for the first time this year. So it was all good. The Yankees got revenge, a series split. No one's going to get in fist fights now because they tied. All the Yankee and Met fans will shake hands and peace be with us.
Until October.
Yeah, hopefully, fingers crossed there. I didn't hear it on the Mets broadcast, but I know David on the Yankees broadcast, Michael Kay tried to get it out of you in terms of you and Keith playing carpool, going to the ballpark earlier and the discussions, I guess, that you were having. Were you driving? Did you actually pick up Keith? Did you have a driver? What was going on there?
I did. I had a driver in Manhattan, and Keith was staying in the city. And, you know, we know Keith, everybody knows he's big Sag Harbor resident out there, but every now and then he's in the city. So yeah, he called, of course. It was great to see him. I picked him up, had a car service, even better. We could sit in the back seat. It's kind of like Jerry Seinfeld's new series, right? Riding in the car with Keith Hernandez. So yeah, it was great to hang with Keith. I mean, we go way back to the 80s with the Mets. Keith was my guy, took me under his wing, taught me how to pitch. You know, he gave me confidence. Keith was one of those guys on first base that would yell encouragement and come to the mound and tell you what to do, what not to do. He was a real leader, you know, and that's a big part of the history of the Mets. That's why they retired his number, deservedly so, number 17 now forever, part of forever. Congratulations, Keith.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, between having number 17 retired earlier this season, you and David are going to be part of Mets Old Timers Day coming up this weekend at Citi Field. There's been like a lot of great celebrations happening. 60th anniversary of the entire organization. It's all happening with the current team playing really well. Yes. How enjoyable has the day-to-day been for you with this team this year?
Well, you know, unlike the Yankees, the Mets have had a lot more failure than success. So there's been a lot of years where Mets are playing meaningless games this time of year. And it makes the season go by slow. This season has just really gone by fast, but we got 38, 37 games left. We got a two-game lead. It's going to be very exciting. The last week of the season, the Mets go to Atlanta and play three. They would go in there with whatever lead or whatever they're behind with six games to play. And that could mean the division right there. And that's with the new playoff format, that's important to win the division to get that first week bye. But it's been, you know, the new ownership, Steve Cohn, he invested $200 million plus in five players that were all in their 30s, early 30s. And Scherzer, of course, was 38. He's a Met fan. He wanted this year to be special, 60th anniversary, as you mentioned. And he wanted to bring home a world championship. And he did everything he possibly could. He spent the money. The five players he brought in have made a big, big, have had a big impact on the team in a very, very, very positive way. The hiring of Buck Showalter might have been the best hire that he, the best move he made in the offseason, because Buck has really changed the culture. And the guys play hard, they're fun to watch. And we'll see how it goes. There's 37 to go, I believe, and that's why they play the game. So it's a two-game lead. Yankees now, I don't know, they go nine with those two wins. Are they eight or nine back right now? Ahead,
I should say.
So, you know, they've got a little more comfort level, but they have worries with their injuries. And, you know, when you get to the postseason, anything can happen. It's the best teams in the end, and that's why it's the postseason. The best teams get there.
Keith, you know, everybody that we've had on our podcast, I got to get some background, and I know yours, but I want to know, you know, a lot of the fans want to know the personal story behind you, the strong relationship with your father,
yep,
your brother, the history of your father as a ball player himself. And I remember with the Mets back in 1987, my first year, I came into the clubhouse in between innings one time, and you're on the phone with your father during the game. There's pine tar on Davey Johnson's phone.
Yes, I was.
Your father had a satellite dish watching your at-bat. You actually had your talk to your father during the game. So can you give us just a little background on your personal history there?
Oh, there was a little bit of dependence there. He taught me how to hit. He was my hitting instructor. So since we were, my brother and I were little kids, we started first, the first lessons was learning how to throw properly. He was a first baseman, left-handed thrower, very good fielder, got as high as double A. And he taught my brother and I how to play and play first base. And we were both left-handed, so our options are limited. We're either going to play the outfield pitch or play first base. And so I had a step ahead of everybody, but he also taught us how to hit. And yes, I would get on the phone and call him. You busted me there, David. I forgot to towel down the phone
with that yeah, alcohol phone.
To get the to stick them off the phone. And that was back in the day where you couldn't dial direct. There's no cell phones. You had to call operator.
How often did you do that?
The Mets operator and go, I'm Keith Hernandez. I'm calling my father. Here's the number. Get him quick. It's in the game's on. And then I would just have a quick conversation. And I would call mainly when I was slumping or I wasn't feeling comfortable at the plate. And, you know, that's a bit of a dependence. It's not, I probably could have handled it better, but he kind of like lived my life kind of through me. And we had that special relationship where we could communicate. I mean, I remember in the minor leagues or in St. Louis when there was he couldn't watch me, but we were able to communicate. I could tell him how I felt at the plate. And we had that kind of communication. Whether it's, you know, just getting a positive from your father, you know, who's your strong guy, who's your tutor, who knows? It's probably more psychological than the real physical of a slump or a bad swing.
Was there any time when, I know you said you usually did that when you were slumping, was there any one piece of advice, one specific conversation that sticks out to you when you had a rush through, give him a call through the operator over the years?
No, there's nothing that was really, you know, there was nothing that really, really stands out. The only thing that stands out was I was in AAA and I led the league in hitting in the American Association. Ken Boyer was my manager, and that was 1974. And I was just wearing it out. And we went to Denver to play the Denver Bears. And I was at Mile High Stadium, so the ball always carried there. I was just so red hot. I flew my father into, because I really wanted to show my dad at the top of my game where I had advanced. And he came in for the four-game series, and I just wore it out. And, you know, that was a big stepping stone for me as far as getting to the big leagues.
You know, it is amazing when you look at your career. especially with the Cardinals. You know, the thing that stands out to me, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of your career, you know, you had the MVP season, obviously back in 79, 344 batting average, 48 doubles that year. But at the end of the day, your career, you had more walks than strikeouts. I mean, you had 1,070 walks and only 1,012 strikeouts. So, I mean, you were kind of a high on base percentage before Moneyball, before it was a big thing. I mean, you were an all around hitter. Was that something you guys thought about back then? Or is that just something that was just part of your routine?
Well, there was never the term on base percentage. But my father always said, the two prideful and the game has changed now where a lot of the best hitters, you hit Judge second. And I still don't understand that because you're going to get Judge up in the first inning, the leadoff, but no one on. The leadoff hitter doesn't get on every time. I don't understand how you could hit someone second. And I don't care what the stats show. Your third hitter is was your best hitter, your line drive hitter, guy that got on base and also was your clutch hitter and your best average hitter. Then your cleanup hitter was your Aaron Judge, your Pete Alonso, Harmon Killebrew, those kind of guys. And then your fifth hitter was on down. Fifth and sixth hitters were power hitters as well and RBI guys. And you had the table setters up front in one and two. And I think we're getting back to that. But that was instilled in me. My dad always said, you want to be the number three hitter. That was a prideful spot. And I could think of my day growing up, Dodgers, Tommy Davis, Tony Oliva, all the great hitters that were the best hitters. And so it was a very prideful thing. And my dad always instilled that your job as the third hitter is that you are the average hitter. You drive in the big runs. You're a clutch hitter, average hitter, but you get on base for four, five, and six as well. So that is on base percentage, but without the term. Because there was no term back then. So that was instilled in me. And that's why I walked a lot. You know, I could look back on my career and I go, boy, I could have been a little more selfish, could have swung at a few red hot, could have swung on a few pitches, fouled them back, stayed in the at bat. I could have gotten more hits. But it was all about, I had Darryl behind me, Carter, McReynolds with the Mets. I had Ted Simmons behind me in New York, all and George Hendrick. All my four hitters, I'm very prideful about that, drove, when I was a number three hitter, they all drove in 100 runs. And I scored 100 runs twice, I think. I always scored in the 90s. It was all about scoring runs, too. To me, I like the RBIs, runs scored, minus the home runs, because you can't double up on the runs. So you always wanted to be 200. And that's a productive year.
296 career average with a 384 on base percentage. That is something you didn't really see.
I lost my 300 average the last two seasons with my injuries. That just pisses me off.
Well, you have more than 80 points higher in on-base percentage than batting average. That's a really good indication of someone who's providing more value on top of the strong batting average. And this is all being done the late 70s and the 80s. It was a very pitcher-friendly time, especially in the National League. So to put up the kind of offensive numbers then, very impressive.
Well, I guess I could hit a little bit. And, you know, it was St. Louis was AstroTurf. And I lost a lot of extra base hits going to Shea Stadium. But both ballparks, I thought, were fair. Dave, did you think that Shea was big or fair?
I thought it was fair. You know, we enjoyed pitching there. It was a fair ballpark.
I thought it was slightly big, not much. But Busch Stadium was large. It was the second largest stadium compared to the Dome, the Astrodome. So when I played there, you know, when the summer came and David's pitched there, and you're one story underground, below street level, and you kind of baked in there. When the summer came, you hit the ball in the gap. It was 386 in the gap. You couldn't get it out of the gap. So you had to hit line drives. And that's why I had the average, because I couldn't lift the ball. And I was a gap to gap hitter. I wasn't a pull hitter. I was always prided myself on hitting a lot of doubles and driving in runs.
So you come to the Mets and you got, you know, you hear about these young guys, Dwight Gooden and Darryl Strawberry. And then, you know, Frank Cashin is the guy that's running things there. And when you get to New York, obviously a big change from St. Louis. When do you start to feel it? When do you start to say, hey, wait a minute, this is going to work? Obviously you can't think about at that point, you know, winning a World Series or maybe getting your number retired one day. But when did it start to click when you finally got to New York?
I felt in the around the 2-3 weeks into 2 weeks into spring training in 84, my first full season. And I got to see Daryl. I got to see Ron Darling. It was Walt Terrell then at that time. Wally Backman. Lenny was a non-roster guy that was hanging around. And I saw him. And, you know, he had Doc, of course. And I saw the young talent there, and I saw the exuberance. So that's when I realized around 2 weeks in that, hey, we got a chance here to kind of turn this around. I never dreamed that we would contend for the division in 84 with the Cubs. I mean, we won 90 games that year for a team that was 7 years in a row was in last place. But as the season progressed too, it just kept on building up more evidence that this was a club that we get the right players here, a couple of nice players, we can turn it around. And Carter turned out to be the last piece. And you too.
Yeah. Keith, you're a member of two teams Hall of Fames, Mets Hall of Fame, Cardinals Hall of Fame. Yes. I know there's a lot of history, a lot of success with the St. Louis organization. Overall though, like what is it like being revered by two fan bases, both National League, but a little bit different in their own respect?
Well, it means a lot. I mean, I was fortunate enough where I wasn't traded around and became like a vagabond and, you know, got traded, played for 5 or 6 or 7 teams. You know, I was very fortunate to really, Cleveland was my last year, and I was finished then. But basically played for two teams, never really got uprooted, so to speak, just once. And, you know, the Cardinals are a team that's steeped in tradition. And, you know, they've won the most World Series in National League. They're second to the Yankees. But I feel that they are second to the Yankees as far as tradition is concerned. And to be a part of that and all their great players, Rogers, Hornsby, Joe Medwick, Dizzy Dean, the list goes on. To be a part of that amongst those guys means a lot. And I grew up a Cardinal fan, so it's kind of a dream come true. And then the Mets are, a young franchise, not now 60 years, but there's plenty of great players that have passed through. So it's a great honor to be in two Hall of Fames.
Wonder what it's like for both of you here with Mets Old Timers Day coming up. Very different thing, right? You, Keith, you mentioned it with the 60th anniversary being this season. Things have kind of changed course. What are you two looking forward to the most with Mets Old Timers Day coming up this weekend?
Well, I think number one, see the guys. There's going to be some 62 players there, which is going to be wonderful. Those that could travel. I think there'll be three of them. Not sure. That'll be fun. And then there'll be other guys that I played against as a Cardinal and some I played with. It'll be fun. I know David and I probably should be on the IL. We both had hip replacement, and I'm not too anxious about taking a swing, and that's all I need is to pop my hip out of socket and have to have another surgery. I don't need that.
I've got to sign beforehand, injury waivers. Indemnify the Yankees. It's great. I mean, there's no doubt that there's a new sheriff in town with the Mets, and we feel it all over New York City. You know, the ownership changed, the resources are there, the whole culture's changed, as Keith described with Bulk Showalter. I think one of the things that surprised me, you know, Keith, is when you sort of cross the line into broadcasting, you know, you still think like a player, but then all of a sudden when you're on the broadcasting side and you have to critique the players, you kind of die a little death inside, or you change a little bit. And I think, Buck, you told me the story where Buck Showalter took you in the golf cart in spring training and took you around the minor league complex and made sure that people knew who you were and what your history was. And that changed things for you and your perspective. And, you know, that's the thing that's going on with the Mets this year that I think really is interesting to me. I feel that as a broadcaster, where sometimes you go down the clubhouse and the players look at you sideways because maybe you were critical then the night before. And that's a hard thing for a player, you know, a great player, that leader like you were. For me, it was hard to kind of get on the other side of the fence and get used to that.
It's hard to separate. And I've been out of it. How long? When was your last year? When did you retire?
2003 with the Mets, actually. Okay. 03.
Right. I retired 12 years before you. So I'm 12 years further removed. And I don't, you know, feel like I know I can't play anymore. I mean, my gosh, it hurts to get in and out of the car, for crying out loud. And it does, you know, when I started doing it, you're still a player and you don't want to be labeled as a member of the media, you know, because right. we played in New York. It was a tough meet, much tougher media back then than it was than it is today. You still had Dick Young, you had Mike Lupica, you had Bob Clappich. There was the tabloids, which are still there, but it was much more difficult to negotiate. And but you know, right now I'm fine with it. I always say that just keep in mind that it looks easier up in the booth, and you got to keep that in mind. It's not easy to, you know. I asked Tom Seaver one time. I said, when you threw like a 3-hit shutout, complete game, how many mistakes do you think you made in that game? And he goes, oh, maybe 3 or 4. No, 100 and what pitches? And you only make 3 or 4 mistakes? That's not easy to do. And it's for the hitter, it's not easy to hit, fail 70% of the time. What I don't have any patience for is stupid play in the field and bad fundamentals. That bad base running, that drives me up a wall. But not everybody has baseball instincts, and not everybody's a superstar. And, you know, it takes 25 to win, and not everybody's a Daryl Strawberry or an Aaron Judge or David Cohn, you know.
Guys, here's one of the things that fascinates me about your friendship between the two of you, David and Keith. And obviously, baseball is only a small part of a friendship here, but we know how David feels about some of this new age information. And Keith, you've made it pretty clear in the past that while it can be useful, most of the new age data, the information is kind of oversaturating the sport. Has there ever been a passionate argument with you two revolving around new age stats versus that old school feel?
At first, I was very resistant to it and probably very conservative and unfair. But as you become more aware of it, there are things in that analytics and metrics that are very helpful. And I talked to Buck, and I talked to Frank Robinson when Frank was managing Montreal and the Nationals. And Frank said, I throw away half of it, more than half of it, but there's some vital stuff in there. And Buck, it's a wealth of information. What I don't like is a dependence on it. I want more eyes watching the game. And I mean, Elias sent me when I retired a list of all the pitchers I ever faced in my career from the most in chronological order. With Steve Carlton, I had over 150 at bats. And I was surprised over my 17-year career that I only hit off maybe 26 at-bats off Bedrosian. All these relievers, Gene Garber, who was there forever, I had maybe 30 at-bats. But I knew what they had. I would have swore I had, for me to know what they had, I would have had to face them 50 times. I had guys I faced in the teens, and I looked all the way down. That's what interested me more, was that I had guys I faced 15 times and I knew what they had and I knew how they liked to pitch me. And they were always relievers, of course, because the starters I'd face more. So we didn't grow up with computers. And these guys today, they've grown up with computers. And we have come to realize that that's how they have been brought through. Pete Alonso is, Jose Reyes was ours on analytics. And to me, it's too much. All I want to know, if I ask the guy, well, how's his fastball? Does it sink? Is it straight? Does it run? How's his breaking ball? It's flat. And then to go up there, how's his changeup? Is it sink? Is it straight? That's all I need to know. And then go up there and you see all of his pitches in one at bat, hopefully, and you got a gauge on what his pitches are. Then it comes a process of finding out how he likes to pitch you, and particularly when you can beat him with men on base.
Yeah, you know, we really haven't had a chance to delve into it quite a lot. You know, Shaq, to answer your question, you know, for me, everybody seems to put everything under one umbrella, analytics all under one umbrella. And I think that's a big mistake. There's so many different subsets. If you want to talk about sabermetrics and whether you should bunt or not, or strategy, then certainly that's a conversation Keith and I can have and probably go on for hours. But in the other realm of some of the analytics, it's the high-speed cameras analyzing the spin on my curveball. And that's the kind of feedback I'm obsessed with. You know, I spent my whole life trying to spin a baseball, you know, since I was a little kid throwing wiffle balls. And now I've got this information that I wish I would have had when I was pitching. I would have used it for pitch design. Hey, if I tweak my grip here, the spin and the revolutions and the spin axis is doing this and your break is going to change this much and you can get into pitch design. That's fantastic information. That's a subset of analytics that is tremendous for pitchers that they're using nowadays to great success. So if you're the type of person who wants to throw it all under one umbrella, analytics is ruining the game. I got a big problem with you on that, because then I'm going to ask you, well, which part of it? Well, you know, we're not talking about whether you should bunt, sacrifice bunt or not. We're talking about biomechanics and athletes learning how their bodies move and also pitch design and learning how the ball spins and how to increase the spin on a fastball or a curveball. That's a whole different realm than whether or not you should sacrifice bunt or not.
And another thing too is, and I talked with Jim Cotton about this, is, okay, this pitcher throws breaking balls, you know, X amount of times late. Okay, how does he throw that breaking ball when it's the eighth inning and he's got runners in scoring position and he's protecting a one-run lead or a tie ball game? A lot of, you know, that's what I want to know when he's throwing that. I don't know if analytics provides that. I just don't know. I don't think it does. And, you know, there's a lot of mediocre breaking balls out there. It was in my time. And the spin rate is great. I don't give a crap about spin rate. I don't care about exit velocity. I know that the guy hit like Judge's home run to left field last night. I know he hit the dog out of it. I don't want to know, okay, 115 miles an hour, whoop-de-doo. You know, spin rate, Carlton. I can see Carlton's slider. He had extraordinary spin rate. Don Sutton, great curveball, extraordinary spin rate. Bert Blylevin. But those are the guys with the great curveballs. You know, they were the great pitchers. They're all those three guys are in the Hall of Fame.
Hey, all you men out there, is crotch discomfort hurting your game? Well, fear no more. The kings of crotch comfort, Manscaped, they have spent two long, hard, arduous years locked up in a lab designing the most comfortable boxer briefs out there. They are sleek, they are soft, they're flexible, and they are, above all else, comfortable. It's the brand new Boxers 2.0 from Manscaped. They will take your balls to the Royal Ball Throne. The global leaders in below-the-waist grooming also have the Lawnmower 4.0 for the trimming, so you can wear the Boxers 2.0 for the chilling. They even trademarked the jewel pouch, so you know it is serious. I always say self-investment is the best thing you can do for yourself. It is time that you invest in your family jewels. So let your bulge breathe and get 20% off and free shipping by using our code SLAB, that's S-L-A-B, at manscaped.com. Here's what you get with the Lawnmower 4.0. Not only is it the best electric trimmer for below-the-waist grooming, it keeps on developing. This is a fourth-generation trimmer featuring a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to the advanced skin-safe technology. It also is waterproof. It has a 400K LED spotlight that you are going to need for a more precise shave. And that leads to the boxers. They are a game changer. They have micro-model fabric, which is so buttery soft and breathable. It keeps all your good stuff down there all cool. You can walk, you can run, you can strut. It doesn't matter. They have moisture-wicking boxers that allow you to breathe without breaking a sweat. Be proud of your underwear and wear the Manscaped waistband with a badge of honor. Your balls deserve it. Get 20% off and free shipping with our code SLAB, S-L-A-B, at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with our code SLAB at manscaped.com. Up your crotch game, because once the Boxers 2.0 touch your sack, you are never going to go back.
David, James, and I, we have this discussion periodically how the pitching, as far as technology goes, and the strategy built off that technology is ahead of the hitting in this day and age. You know, hitters, for the most part, it feels like if you compare it to the overall strategy of the pitcher in today, they're still trying to figure out which way to go, what they should do. What part of today's hitting fascinates you?
Is that a question for me?
That's a question for you. One of the near 300 hitters of all time, if it wasn't for his last two seasons.
When I see a hitter take a fastball down the pipe with two strikes, he's guessing. He got set up. And I happened to me, and I would be, and when it happened to me, I would walk back to the dugout and I'd just say, that guy is never going to do that to me again. And I looked fastball and adjusted to a curveball. Now, not every hitter in the big leagues, a lot of them are bad breaking ball hitters, and they have to look for a breaking ball. Howard Johnson, the David knows, was not a good breaking ball hitter. He became a good breaking ball hitter with experience and confidence, but he looked for it. I didn't have to look for a breaking ball because I could adjust to it. I had that ability. So that was a plus for me. And I would always come in the dugout, and guys would say, oh, I'd hit a breaking ball. You were looking for that breaking ball. And I'd say, yeah, I was. Just because, like Rusty Staub said, never tell the truth. Guys get traded. They'll go run and tell their teammates. So yes. I always told everybody, yeah, I was looking for that curveball. Oh, yeah, I was looking for a breaking ball. And I wasn't. I was sitting dead red. And that's why I always would happen with Judge on first home run opposite field against Scherzer. He took the fastball knee-high outside corner. Dave and I talked about it. In game one of the series, he took that second strike fastball, and Scherzer thought he was looking for a breaking ball and tried to sneak another one by him, and Judge wasn't, and he hit the home run to right field. That's the cat and mouse of the pitcher and the hitter. But when you look fastball, it takes away all that element. I don't like the guessing. You get in trouble when you guess.
What about your tips? I know Rusty Staub was one of the greatest thing at picking up gloves or tips, you know, and the whole Houston Astros thing, banging the trash can, you know, I mean, that's a whole different level. I think the layman kind of gets lost in what's gamesmanship and what is actually, you know, over the line cheating. I mean, were you a guy that picked up tips from the glove, a pitcher fan in his glove, or look for little things?
Most of my career, I didn't want to know. And not until Rusty in 84, and we had this conversation the other night, he had that little red book. And
yes,
he finally gave me that little red book when I retired. And I went back and looked. He had guys like Bob Friend, Jim Maloney, Jim Bunning. It's going back to the 60s with these pitchers of how they tipped their pitches. Rusty was great at it. He said he learned it from Gene Mock when he went to Montreal. And I, late in my career, 84, 85, when we had that year, Rusty's last year, and we won 98 games, Rusty started first time in August, with 6 weeks left in the season, started telling me what to look for. And I did use it, but I was a veteran and I could use it. I was afraid to do it when I was young. I was just afraid. A lot of guys are afraid to use it their whole career.
Yeah, Paul O'Neill was that way. Can you imagine having Rusty Staub's little red book? What that would go for eBay on eBay right now?
I have it here right now.
Oh my God! Rusty Staub's little red book of pitcher tips.
I don't know where I put
back
it.
To Bob.
I would not have thrown it away.
Oh my God, that thing is just
I would have
priceless.
It's unbelievable. But
priceless. Oh my.
One of the big ones was, we'll just say, we talked Nolan Ryan in a windup would look down at his glove and his windup fastball. And when he threw his curveball, he'd go and keep his face pointing home. So that was one big one. And
Nolan Ryan, that'd be pretty good to know when he's gonna throw
it. Someone must have told him, because the next time we went through and played him, he didn't do it. And you know, there's others too. Ed Whitson used to, most of the guys, they fan their glove when they go in and dig in for change for the breaking ball and secondary pitch, they open their glove up. And,
yeah, I did. That's what I did. Yeah, you know.
That is awesome. Yeah, that book,
then that's not cheating.
That's not gamesmanship. No. Exactly. That's the difference between banging on a trash can when you get the feed from the center field camera.
That's through natural observation. And it just so happens you put pen to paper. Awesome. So
the 84 Cubs had, they had WGN. They televised all their games. They would have their backup catcher go up and watch the signs and the cadence and the signs of men on base. And then come back in the dugout and they would tell them the code. So if someone got on second base, they can give the sign. Larry Boa would always take runners on first and second. I'd play behind him. Boa told me he would take an extra big lead to peek around the catcher's right knee, and then they would transmit the sign. The Cubs were the best team at that, and at 84-14 when they won the division and lost to the Padres. They were the best team in the National League, and that was the Padres got crushed by Detroit. But anyway, all the little things.
Yeah.
Keith, Max Scherzer. What's something that you've learned about him this season that you didn't know before?
Well, he's Buck's top platoon sergeant down there. He's brought a tenacity to that club. Our club has been kind of soft in the past. And as well, the five guys that they brought, Marte, Canna, Escobar, and I can't think of the fourth, but they're all brought a professionalism, but no one has brought the personality and the intensity of Scherzer. And you can tell our young David Peterson and I can't think of the other guy. It's on the IL right now.
Oh, McGill.
McGill, yeah. They were all sponges around him in the dugout. And darn right. I was always a sponge around hitters, veteran hitters, to pick up what I can. You learn from the veterans. And even when he's not pitching in a dugout, he is in the game and he's talking and he's paying attention, and it's infectious. And everybody's paying attention. And I think he's been a big part of it. He pitched game one against the Yankees, and the Mets had the game in Philadelphia and they were busing home. And Buck said, you can go home, miss the game. Go home and get your rest. Go have a nice meal with your family. Get a good night's sleep because I want you ready for game one. He said, no, I'm not leaving my team. I'm going to be there. I want to watch. And Buck said, no, you go. He goes, nope, I'm not going. And he stayed.
That's impressive. Yep. That tells you something about a team guy. And starting pitchers that are team guys like that, that means something, I think. It really does. I mean, because they had the free pass. Like you said, here's your hall pass. You can take it, and you don't, and you stay. That sends a message.
I don't know how you starters could watch four games in between starts. When I got on my first time on the disabled list, when I got hurt my first time after my 14th season, when I pulled my hammy in St. Louis, I had a hard time watching again. There's Haji. I hear him.
Get a guest appearance from Haji.
Well, I'll go get him. he's just right around the corner. I can hear him. But I had a hard time staying on the bench and watching nine innings. And we were playing only, 2.5 hour games.
Yeah.
I can't imagine 3.5 hour games. That'd drive me nuts.
Yeah. Now you know why. See, guys, right there's a perfect example why pitchers are flakes. That is it, right, in a nutshell. I played 17 years in the big leagues. I got to play in about 30 to 33 games a year. So yeah, yep. The rest of the time was just sitting. Look, there's Haji, the famous Haji right there.
He's here. He is going to be 20 October 10th. He's starting to lose his eyesight.
Wow.
Starting to lose his eyesight and his hearing.
Wow.
He can't see very well at night, but he's okay. He's doing good. He's in good health.
Nice.
Hodge. So, anyway.
Very nice. Now we got Keith Hernandez and Haji on Towing in the Slab. So, my day is made.
Keith, what's the background for the listeners, the viewers here? What's the background on Haji's name?
Haji's name, he's a Bengal, which is a breed. And the Bengal is also a province in India, the subcontinent. And in Johnny Quest cartoons, Johnny Quest's best friend was Haji, who was a subcontinent Indian. And he had the turban. And so that's where his name comes from.
Okay.
You can Google it.
Johnny Quest.
Johnny Quest, yes. Haji, Johnny Quest. And we'll see.
It's great.
Haji's namesake.
David, really quick, just because we were talking about Max Scherzer, his influence on some younger pitchers. Who were some young pitchers that gravitated toward you during games in the dugout?
When I was with the Mets, like he said, I kind of bounced. I was 6 years with the Mets and 6 years with the Yankees. The majority of my career was in New York. You know, I was in Kansas City with the Royals a little bit, a couple different stints, a couple tries in Toronto. I actually hanging around Pat Henkin with the Blue Jays was one of those guys. He ended up winning a Cy Young Award with the Blue Jays, but he was a kid when I got traded from the Mets. Actually, I think it was yesterday in 1992. the Mets traded me to the Blue Jays, and that was Canada's first World Series in 1992. So I got traded right to Toronto, found myself in the World Series and hanging around a young Pat Henkin. And he really was one of those guys that impressed me. He wanted to know everything. He's one of those kids that, yeah, it was really respectful, deferential, and followed you around, wanted to play catch with you in the outfield before the games. And he just absorbed it all. And he ended up being a great pitcher himself, ended up winning the Cy Young. So that was one guy I would point to that, you know, if you're a young pitcher, like he's saying, and you're hanging around Max Scherzer, you better do it. You better get all you can while he's there. And because there's a lot of things that, you know, I guess I'll put it this way. Keith's forgotten more about hitting than I'll ever know. A guy like Max Scherzer's probably forgotten more about pitching than some of these young kids will ever know. So, yeah, you got to try to bring it out of them and hang around them. That's the whole point of just trying to, you know, get whatever you can while you can.
Keith, do you think Jacob DeGrom is learning anything from Max Scherzer?
No, I think Jacob's he's already on that his own level with where Max is at. And although Jacob's just younger, Max is 38 and Jacob's 32, 33, I think. I'm not sure, maybe 34. But no, I think that Jacob knows what he needs to do. It's just a matter of him staying healthy.
Yeah, it seems that way. I was just checking housekeeping here. You talked about Buck.
But you know what, too? Sorry to interrupt. Max could learn something from Jacob, and Jacob could learn something from Max. You know, I talked to Max one time. David, this is interesting. Max said when I was with Detroit, Maurer, warm out, left-hand hitter, right, batting champion. He said, and all I had was the curveball and the fastball. And he goes, and I threw hard, and he killed me. And he said, I can't remember the pitcher for Detroit, but he ate up Maurer. And he said, I finally went up after seeing him around three starts, just Maurer looking terrible. I said, what are you doing to get Maurer out? He goes, I throw him a cutter inside. And he goes, teach me, show me how you hold it. And that's how Max developed his cutter. He said, then he got the cutter and he got Max started getting Maurer out. That made perfect sense, right, Dave?
Yeah, that's dead on. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not only grips and learning new pitches, but how to approach tough hitters like that. Absolutely. That's how you learn, through osmosis. You know, you watch the guy do it, you ask him the question, you see the success, and then you emulate it. And a lot of times that's exactly how it goes down.
And Max doesn't throw the cutter to the right-hander because it doesn't break that much. And it tends to be
flat. Yeah.
You want to get it in on the hands of a left-hander. He throws the slider and he has a slow, curveball to the right-handers, and he does not throw them the cutter. So he's smart.
Yeah.
Keith, how well did you know Buck Showalter before this season?
Hardly, other than I always had a scowl on his face. And I said, this guy's an honoree, but he's goofy. He's got a great personality. He's funny as heck. And boy, he's a hell of a manager. I mean, in every degree, I've learned so much this year. We're allowed to meet with him every first game in his office for around a half hour. And usually it goes 40 because once Buck gets rolling, he doesn't shut up. And, but it's just the two radio guys, Howie Rose and Wayne, and Gary, Ron, and me. And that's it. And we have meeting with him first game of every series. And he trusts us that if he says this is, you know, I don't want you to mention this on the air, we don't. But I've learned so much about managing, just listening to him. Before, I would go down occasionally in the years past, listen to the manager, do a ho-hum pregame. But this is like going to school, and I don't miss it. And I just realized that, like I told David the other night, I am so ill-equipped to manage. And everybody thinks, oh, Keith, you should manage the Mets. I am not. I would be a horrible manager.
Yeah, Buck will take you to school, that's for sure. How much did it mean that he grabbed you early, though, and said, hey, come with me in spring training, got you in the golf cart, took you around, and made sure did that kind of rejuvenate you a little bit or get you back, you know, into it a bit in terms of just, you know, that other side of the fence broadcaster, we're going to stay up in the booth and, you know, you're worried about, you know, maybe players are pissed off at you because you said something critical. I mean, did that brought you back in a little bit, didn't it?
It did, but it didn't surprise me, because what surprised me was 2 weeks after he was hired, because I came out in the offseason and there was four prospects for manager, and I was keeping my fingers crossed. Please, this club needs a veteran manager and a guy that has got a strong personality. And I was relieved when they hired him. I'm sitting around 2 weeks later and I get a phone call and it's Buck. And we had an hour and a half conversation. He goes, he wanted to know what I felt about the organization, the team, specific players. And he goes, I want to draw on you. You're a baseball guy. I want to draw on what you feel. And he goes, when you come to spring training at the opening, when you first day you're there, I'm going to drive you around a cart. Let everybody see you with me so they know. And so I expected that. So that wasn't a surprise. What was the surprise was a manager of his experience. I mean, he's got three manager of the years. He's managed in postseason. He's managed in New York. And for him to call me, and the first manager ever to reach out to me and want my opinion, that really took me by surprise. That says a lot about him.
Yes.
He could be on his way to a fourth Manager of the Year award with the job that he's doing here.
You got that right.
Yeah. One more before we wrap it up, let you go here. The toughest part about the NL East at this point in the year, what is it?
For the Mets.
Maybe for all teams, or how they compete with the Braves and the Phillies.
Mets don't play the Braves until the last week of the season, and that's in Atlanta for three. It could be decided by then. It's the stretch run. It's the dog days. I hate the term grind, and that seems to be the word. But it is a grind, and it's hot in August. You know, you get that shot in the arm when the weather changes in September. It starts getting cool, and you get that, you really got to push through, for me, the second half of July through August were the toughest 6 weeks of the season, because I played every day, and it was, you had to really reach in and reach and go for it, not give in, and to go out there and do it every day, same intensity. And then September came and it got cooler, and then you got a shot in the arm. In our day when we played all in division in September, and I missed that. I mean, now we're going to play Cincinnati. We're going to play the Pirates twice. We're going to play Oakland. We got a very soft schedule. It should be in September. It should be in September. You're playing in division. We're done with the Phillies. We're done.
Yeah, and Harper's coming back too. So you miss Harper coming back.
Yep, and Harper's going to come back. And the Braves on September 16th in a 10-day period will play seven games against the Phillies, starting September 16th. We have a lot of second division teams that we're going to play against. We have the softest schedule in the division. So, but we'll see. That's why they play the game. There's no guarantee. I always love September because you were playing against the competition, and that's where it should be. And it doesn't look like it's going to get back there, because now we're going to play next year every team in the American League. I don't know what these guys on Park Avenue are thinking about. They're out of their minds. They're just out of their minds.
Mets Rangers doesn't do it for you?
Name a few more. You'd be right. I mean, I'd rather find a way to play twice, even if it's like, okay, I know scheduling is difficult, but okay, instead of having, once a year you play the AL East and the Central the next year and West the next year, why not have just two of your crosstown rivals and then play, okay, one year the Mets would play, or the Yankees would play the Central twice, home and away. Next year, play the West home and away twice. Keep it in the league. You're deciding a pennant in the divisions on teams playing in the American League. And sometimes the last weekend of the season, they're playing an American League team. Right. It's an interleague game. I mean, come on. Give me a break. It's crazy.
Yeah, things are going to look a lot different moving forward, for sure, starting next year with the expanded schedule. One thing that I would agree with you, Keith, you said it right at the top, We should get more Subway Series games, especially when things are going as well as they have for these two teams this year. The buzz, the juice that it creates in both stadiums is at its highest right now. It's right. Fascinating. Thanks well, so much.
On the other end, with Oakland being so terrible, will they play the Giants? I mean, the Oakland's going to draw more playing the Giants. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever.
No, it's a fascinating. It's not even a debate. But yeah, what they're doing up there, we'll talk about that another day for sure.
Yeah,
Keith, thanks again. This has been wonderful.
All right,
enjoy Old Timers Day this weekend, and congratulations again on everything that you were celebrated for earlier this season. Well deserved. Thanks again for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it.
All right, David. I'll see you. Okay. I'll see you Saturday.
See you Saturday.
Guys, I don't know about you, but when Keith was reaching for the Rusty Staub red book there, I was about to ask him, hey, flip to a random page and start reading, man. Let's go. But he gave the Nolan Ryan MO right off the top of his head. I thought that was impressive.
Yeah, I mean, Rusty Staub is a legend, and he was the king of keeping notes on pitchers and their tells and their tips and little secrets, a secret red book of Rusty Staub, and he's got it somewhere in his house in Sag Harbor. We got to get our hands on that thing. I mean, that is just gold. I almost fell out of my chair when I heard that he still had it. He started reaching in his desk, like, I got it right here. I know I still got it, and that blew me away.
Le Grand Orange with 500 plus hits with four different teams, Mets, Astros, Expos, and Tigers. Rusty Staub, a great hitter with 2,716 hits in his career. He started 19, he started 41, and everywhere in between.
That book needs to make it to City Field this weekend for Old Timers Day. That's an impressive artifact right there.
Really, that's a Hall of Fame book, in my opinion.
All right, guys, this week in pitching history, James, what do you have for us?
Okay, so August 28th, 2014, that's 8 years ago Sunday, Yusmeiro Petit of the Giants sets a major league record by retiring his 46th consecutive batter. This isn't even part of his 2013 streak when he was one strike away from a perfect game. So let's go back to the start of the streak back on July 22nd. He gets the final batter of a start in Philadelphia. He just gave up five runs, four innings, spot start. You know, you don't think anything of it. Okay. So little did we know, next game, he goes six up, six down in relief. Same thing in the next game. Then he has a 1-2-3 inning, and then another. Then he goes six up, six down again. So he's up to 25. And then a game in Washington, he goes 4 1/3 perfect innings in relief. 13 more batters. He's up to 38. So now he's past a perfect game. The record is Mark Burley in 2009 with 45 batters centered around his perfect game. Petit makes a spot start against the Rockies. He goes 1-2-3 in the first, 1-2-3 in the second. Then he gets the first batter to tie the record, Jackson Williams, with a strikeout. Then he strikes out Charlie Culberson, a new record, 46 batters in a row, retired. Then what happens? He gives up a double to the opposing pitcher, Jordan Lyles, to break the streak. He gives up one run in six innings to get the win. In October, he's a postseason hero, six shutout innings from the 12th to the 17th. In the marathon win in the division series against the Nats, he helps the Giants win the 2014 World Series. He'd already won the Little League World Series with Venezuela in 1994. He's the only player to do that. Yusmeiro Petit, of all pitchers who've ever lived, he has the record, 46 straight batters, a record he set this week in 2014.
Guys, if I were to tell you, guess the age of Yusmeiro Petit, who's like, you know, a name that you just think about along the pitching lines over the last decade plus. He began his career in 2006. How old do you, he began his major league career in 2006, reached the big leagues then. How old would you say Yusmeiro Petit is right now?
Is the four a first number?
Nope.
Yeah, that's what I would have guessed. Over or under 40, right? That's the surprising part for me. If he's under 40, I'm floored by that. I really am.
He's 37. That's wild.
Yeah.
He was in the Padres system at AAA this year. He is not pitching the bigs this year. He got released in June, so that might be the end of the line for Petit, but he was always a really underrated, durable pitcher, swing man. He can go short relief, he can go long relief, he could start. He was a really solid pitcher for a long time.
Yeah.
great control and command. You know, wasn't a power guy, but he knew how to pitch and he was fearless mm-hmm. on the mound.
Made his big league debut in 2006 at age 21. Won that World Series, part of some impressive pitching staffs. Yusmeiro Petit. That's a good one, James. And I cannot believe Yusmeiro Petit's only 2 years older than I.
People, let me tell you about Siegel Law Firm. It is an NYC-based personal injury and civil rights law firm. And what is the big separation between Siegel Law Firm and all those other law firms out there? They truly care about their clients. And sometimes you hear that, you said, oh, that's just a throwaway line. Well, they have what they like to call a Jerry Maguire type approach, where the primary concern is extreme client attention. This means clear, regular communications with clients. They're going to keep you updated on your case, provide assistance with medical providers and insurance issues. And they hire the right experts and put every case in the best chance to succeed. They treat clients like family and have incredible client satisfaction as a result. A lot of firms say this, but they actually do it. Treating clients like family is just one of their core values, and every decision they make is run through those core values. The misconception that you cannot afford a lawyer is not true. There's no cost to consult with Siegel Law Firm and no out-of-pocket costs when they handle your case. You don't pay anything until they recover for you, and then you share in a percentage of that recovery. So there's nothing to lose. Do not disqualify yourself from a case for no reason. It's always worth to call Siegel Law Firm. Give Siegel Law Firm a call or visit them at SiegelLawFirm.com. That's Siegel-LawFirm.com to get the legal support you need. That's SegalLawFirm.com.
Anyway, three up, three down. Guys, what do you have?
James.
All right. I'll lead it off. Edward Cabrera of the Marlins has pitched 22 and a third shutout innings in a row. In the month of August, he just had an eight-inning no-run game with two hits and seven Ks in Oakland the other day, and his changeup is absolutely disgusting. Batters are hitting just 143 against it, slugging 163, no home runs. It's a great pitch. He's on a great roll, and yet another bright young pitcher on the Miami Marlins, Edward Cabrera.
He's good. He's really good. They are deep in the pitching ranks right there. And it makes you wonder, you know, the Yankees were trying to trade for Pablo Lopez over the trade deadline. A lot of rumors of who was in that trade. Was it some of the young shortstops, the Yankees in the minor leagues, you know, Peraza, Volpe, or even Gleyber Torres's name was mentioned in that trade. Did not go down, but they do have a surplus of pitching. It will be revisited this offseason. I'd be surprised if there isn't some moves with their pitching and trying to get some position players in there.
Cabrera, like Coney just said, one of the many flamethrowers that just come out of the Marlins organization. It's sad because you want the offense to match up eventually where they can, you know, be into some serious contention going down the stretch here. But like, I think that maybe masks the fact that the Marlins really produce high quality, high octane arms as good as any organization right now in baseball, right?
They're loaded without a doubt. You know, our friend of the show, Sandy Alcantara, mm-hmm. still, even though he had a rough one against the Dodgers recently, I still think he's the front runner for the Cy Young Award. He's just a monster on the mound. You know, he wants it so badly. I think we all were thoroughly impressed with him when he came on the show with us earlier this year.
I'm sure Cabrera is learning from a guy like Sandy as well. You mentioned the Dodgers. That's where I'm going with my three up, three down. Dustin May returned over the last week. He made his season debut last weekend, coming back from Tommy John surgery. The signature movement on his pitchers, you know, really never left. Didn't look like that was an issue there. So the movement was there. Five scoreless innings, one hit, nine strikeouts, 71 pitches. Yeah, the Dodgers are probably going to be just fine, guys, right?
That's huge. You are correct. His stuff, his flair, the big bushy red hair out of his hat. He's a character. He's a star in the making. And that's a huge difference maker potentially for the Dodgers. They have good pitching. Their guys are having great years, but they're finesse guys. Gonsolin's a finesse guy, having a fantastic year. He deserves to get one of the first few starts in postseason or in big games whenever they arise. And and certainly Anderson as well. The lefties had a great year too, but those guys are finesse guys. They're not the type of guys that, you know, where you get worried if you're the opposing batters, where you're like, oh no, these guys are going to just stuff us tonight. You know, you have a game plan. They may beat you, but you're not worried about getting stuff like a Walker Buehler can do to you. But Dustin May's a guy with 99 mile an hour sinkers and that kind of overpowering stuff can take the ball out of play. You know, that's kind of the modern analytics has taught us. Yeah, it's great to rely on contact, but in big games, sometimes those balls find holes. Sometimes all those ground balls, the Babbitt gods don't shine on you in big games sometimes. And if you're relying on contact a lot, yeah, okay. If you can manage the contact and you have good defense, it can still work out. The Dodgers do. But if you've got a guy that can take the ball out of play a few times when he pitches, you can get strikeouts and swings and misses. That is really valuable in postseason play. It always has been. People think, well, small ball, and James and I have talked about this, you need contact in postseason. No, you need homers and you need power pitchers. The teams with the homers and the power pitchers, you'd rather have that. Yeah, you need contact too, that you need it all. But you know, I'll take my chances with power pitchers and power hitters. The teams who out homer the other teams usually win. The teams who out strike out the other teams with their pitching staff, you know, usually have an advantage as well.
It's about time the Dodgers got a good starting pitcher. So,
yeah, they've been due. if they, you know, do in fact make a run in October, I cannot imagine what it would be like. Just national TV, Dustin May, the presence, everything that David just said about him, he would take October by storm. It would be his launch. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, David, what do you have? Three up, three down.
You know, I'm going to go big picture. You know, I think we talked about the Juan Soto trade and, you know, the Washington Nationals potentially being for sale, the Lerner family. Now we've got the Anaheim Angels. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim are now for sale. Artie Moreno released the statement from the official letterhead of the Angels organization. They hired a firm to explore this, and the Angels are for sale. Wow. I feel like calling Alex Rodriguez. You know, he
bought that was the first name I thought of.
You know, now he's a basketball owner. I'm like, yeah, man, he could have waited. You know, do you still have the resources? I'm sure he does. He could probably put together an ownership group where he might be thinking about it or talking about it right now. But the Angels are valuable. They were bought 20 years ago or so for $180 million. And people want to talk about players making too much money. You know, how could that shortstop that's hitting 230 make this salary, yada, yada, yada. Artie Moreno's going to do fine. I think the price is going to be well north of $2 billion. Who knows where this is going to end up? Yeah, obviously, what happens with the resources? What happens with Shohei Ohtani? Well, that remains to be seen. Mike Trout. Yeah, we know. We know the players. They're the face of the franchise. But I'm really curious to what this franchise ends up getting sold for in that market in Los Angeles and that kind of rate of return over 20 years. Baseball's not dead. Baseball's doing just fine. They're going to do just fine. I would not be surprised to see them push $3 billion on the sale of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. I'd like to win the California Angels. They owned all of California with that name, but I get it. You know, Anaheim needed to be in there, Los Angeles fighting with the Dodgers. I know it's marketing, but that's one valuable franchise, and Artie Moreno is going to do just fine.
Contrary to what Rob Manfred said in the offseason, it is profitable to own a baseball team, especially when you're selling it.
On the back end is when you find out.
Yeah, and now we potentially have two, like you said about the Nationals. We found that out earlier in the start of spring. So you have two within the first 8 months of a calendar year. And that's pretty rare. So I know I was questioning this to you before we started recording because it was one of the first things I thought of. I'm like, oh, wow, you know, you usually could go several years without one franchise being put up for sale. Now we have two within the same calendar year, right after a new CBA was ratified. Anything to that? Probably not, but it could maybe something that we're not aware of at this point from a public eye. But overall, hey, maybe you wish. Want to cash out at the moment because, like James just said, pretty good to be able to take your chips to the counter and go home.
Yeah, it's hard to be a family-run business nowadays because these franchises are so valuable. They've escalated their franchise values enormously over the last couple of decades. And moving forward, yeah, you see the Dodgers are run by a conglomerate, the Guggenheim partners. You need massive resources, obviously, to take it to the next level. So that may be part of it as well. The mom and pop operations, you know, the family run businesses, they're hard. It's hard to maintain that unless you have, you know, wealth from other businesses. If all of your wealth is tied up into the baseball franchise business, the only way you can cash out is to sell it and get it on the back end.
All right, guys, this was a fun episode chatting on a bunch of different things. And we have Mets Old Timers Day coming up this weekend. David, do you plan on stepping onto the field, like putting a glove on? Or
that's a game time decision.
Wow.
We'll see. I mean, I'm probably almost 5 weeks removed from full hip replacement surgery. So I could probably throw a couple pitches in there. Yeah, but I'm not sure. I have to talk to my manager, Willie Randolph. I'm not sure if he knows or not. I told him. I think he forgot because he drafted me number one. So I don't know what he was thinking. But yeah, we'll see. Maybe I could throw a pitch in there. You never know.
Do we know at this point which players are going to be the guinea pigs, the sacrificial lambs are going to have to carry each of their teams?
Well, I know that, you know, Terry Collins and Willie Randolph are the two managers. Terry Collins drafted Bartolo Colon, the big sexy. He's probably going to be on the mound, and you know he's ready to go. I think he's still pitching somewhere in some league, probably, or still throwing bullpens, that's for sure. So the big sexy is going to be tough.
All right, well, next week when you have an ice pack on the YouTube stream, yes, we'll know why for sure. Good luck to you out there, bud.
Thank you.
All right, guys, that's going to do it this week. For this episode, new episodes of the show, they drop each and every Tuesday or on Wednesdays. Please rate, review, subscribe. It's the best way that you can show support for the show. Big thanks to Keith Hernandez for joining us this week. For David Cohn, James Smythe, and our excellent producer, Dan Rourke, this is Justin Shackle. We will talk to you next week on Tone the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn, a production of John Boy Media.